Morning, everyone. Today, Daf in Tzuvos is Kuf Aleph. We're on Kuf on the days. Thank the Lupin Foundation for sponsorship of the Daf. Daf is Lenz Zech and Nishmas Libegar Bela Bashmuel. We're selling off properties, and we're doing so under the auspices of Beis Din. So the properties are not subject to Onah, well, like we discussed extensively yesterday. And even though there may be an adjustment to price, or not an adjustment, but just let's say a mistake was made in terms of the value, but the Mishnah says that under the auspices of the Beis Din, there can be a little bit of latitude in terms of what kind of mistakes we're talking about. Machlokas in the Mishnah between the Tanakhama and Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, what degree of latitude is given to the Beis Din if they sell property and it turns out that they did not sell for the exact price? It's fair market value. So the Tanakhama and the Mishnah says that up to a six, it's fine. Anything beyond a six is considered malpractice on the part of Beis Din, and therefore is to be reversed, and the sale is to be voided. And Reb Shimon Gamliel says no, because we have a principle of Makoch Beis Din Yafa, a principle that we see throughout Shas, and that is that we have to give Beis Din its authority. Beis Din has a certain amount of authority, but we have to empower it. And part of the empowering of Beis Din is to allow them to make mistakes. We're not talking about gross error, but in other words, selling a property of the Yesomim, so Beis Din can do so, and it's given a latitude. Between the two opinions, who do we hold like? Do we hold like the Tanakhama? Do we hold like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel? So in the Mishnah, it's not clear, and Rav Nachman himself also did not have clarity on this issue. In some areas in Halacha, Rav Nachman subscribed to this idea of Makoch Beis Din Yafa, and then in other areas he did not. Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, just reviewing what we saw yesterday, Rabbi Yehuda Anasi wanted to go paskin like the Tanakhama, but then someone whispered in his ear, what about the principle of Makoch Beis Din Yafa? And Rabbi Yehuda Anasi either actually overturned or didn't need to overturn because he never passed in the beginning, but either way, Rabbi Yehuda Anasi then sided to the position of Rabbi Shimon Mingamel. Okay, some of the basic discussions that we had yesterday. The Ad Kama, there were the two dots at the top of the Amud on Kuf Amud Beis. I did a little bit of this. So let's start again from the beginning of the Gemara's discussion. Rav Shimon Gamliel Omer v'chulei the Ad Kama. Now, according to Rav Shimon Gamliel, more latitude is given to the Beis Din, the Gemara is interested in asking a very simple question: how much latitude? So Amar Avuna Bar Yehuda Amar Sheshes Ad Palga. So that's a lot of latitude, up to half. And the Gemara gives, of course, a brisa that supports this as well. Tanya Namihach, Amar Shimon Gamliel, Beis Din Shemachru, Sheva Masayim Bemano, Sheva Mana Bemasayim, Machran Kayam. So if they sold the property that was, should have been 200, they sold for 100. Should have been 100, they sold for 200. So as long as they were half off, so then the sale is going to be a valid sale. The brisa doesn't say that this is the limit, but in other words, in the context of our Gemara, now we could say it. That's the limit. Okay, good. That's all we did yesterday. Now we're on to a new topic. Now, hachraz is something that we discussed yesterday, and if you remember, hachraz is the idea of a public auction. It is the idea that once something is sold in a public auction, we pretty much got fair market value for it. In fact, if you look back at the Mishnah said that if you avalimasu igeres bikaris, if you were sold with some sort of literally an investigation, but that means Rashi pointed out back in the Mishnah. It means that achraza. So then afilo machru shava mana b'masayim, shava masayim b'mana machru kayim. So everyone agrees that that is going to be its price, like we discussed yesterday. Once you're selling in an auction, that's the price. Meaning the auction really is determining what the price is. So the Gemara now quotes a statement by a Meimar. Amar Meimar Mishmei de Rav Yosef Beis Din Shemachru below achraza nasu kamishu tal b'dvar Mishnah v'chozrin. So the Beis Din selling property but without doing the public auction, so it's like they made an error, a gross error. It's totally b'dvar Mishnah, and therefore their sale has to be voided. So nasu v'adei taos, the Gemara says, why are we using such light language? Meaning it's like they made a gross error. No, it's not like they made a gross error. They did make a gross error. Did not. We have a Mishnah. Shema yisom shloshim yom, shema hektish shishim yom, machrizim bebokar v'erev. The Mishnah Erchin says that when you were appraising the property of orphans to sell off the properties of orphan. So you must do achraz. You must do an auction, public auction, for 30 days. And hektesh, and if you're selling off properties of hektesh, so there you have to do an auction for 60 days, and then you make an announcement in the morning and in the evening. If I remember correctly, the Gemara in Erchin has a discussion, or the Mefarshim over there have a discussion exactly morning and evening every day, morning and evening on Monday and Thursday. Either way. In other words, it is a 30-day auctioning of the property that must be done whenever you're selling off the property of the orphans. So the Gemara says, so what does it mean that if they don't do an auction, it's like they're making a gross error? No, it's not like they're making a gross error. They are making a gross error. So So the Gemara says, well, maybe not. Maybe that Mishnah Erchin is telling me the following. If there's some sort of agency that's selling the property, so then they have to do an auction. Aval Beisdin, loan. But maybe, again, the Havamina is that if Beisdin's selling the property, so maybe no auction is necessary. Maybe Beisdin is considered a public venue, if you will, and no auction is necessary. That's a Havamina Kamash Malan. So the Chiddush is, no, that's not, no such distinction. Whether an agent is selling the property, whether Beisdin is selling the property, in either condition, an auction must be done. So the Gemara says, okay, let's go back to our Mishnah. Meaning, according to Amemar, if Basin sells it without a public auction, that is a gross error, and therefore the sale is voided. What about our Mishnah? Our Mishnah describes Basin selling and making an error. And what kind of error are we describing in our Mishnah? An error of they got the price off. And according to the Tanakhama, if they got it off by a six or more, so then the sale is voided. So, my lav de lo achruz. So the Gemara says, now, in our Mishnah, was there an auction or was there not an auction? So the Gemara is assuming that there was no auction, because we're in the ratio of our Mishnah. So the Gemara says, lo mid achruz. So the Gemara says, no. Our Mishnah is talking about a case where it was a public auction. The Gemara says, that can't be. How mid seifa bid achruz havereisha bid lo achruz? Because look at the totality of the Mishnah. When did the Mishnah talk about a public auction? Only at the end of the Mishnah. So, right, we've been learning Mishnahs together for a long time. We know that if at the end of the Mishnah we're talking about an auction, so that means the beginning of the Mishnah, there was no auction. It was just a sale done by Basin without an auction. So, Diktani Seifa, look at the end of the Mishnah. The Mishnah at the very end tells us that if a public auction was done, so then regardless of how off they were from what the perceived market value of the property is, whatever they generate from the public auction is in fact going to be the valid sale. So that's the end of the Mishnah. So what must be from the beginning of the Mishnah? Beginning of the Mishnah must be there was no auction. The Gemara says, so you of course that's right. Meaning the correct way to learn the Mishnah is that in the beginning of the Mishnah there was no auction. And so now we're stuck. Because a Maimar says that any time that land of the orphans was sold without an auction, that's a gross error done by Beis Din, that's malpractice, and the sale is voided. Meanwhile, we have a Mishnah that we're learning together in the 11th parak of Ksuvos, where clearly the Beis Din is selling not with an auction. Okay, so that's a problem. So lo kasha. The Gemara says there's a couple of ways that we could resolve this difficulty. Number one, kam b'dvarim shemachrizim aleihem, kam b'dvarim shemachrizim aleihem. Not everything is going to get an auction. In other words, some things are going to be sold through an auction, some things are simply not to be sold through an auction, and that's the difference between our Mishnah and a Meimar. For example, three things that are not sold through an auction, and they are avadim, hametaltel, neshtaros, slaves, movables, and documents, and notes. Things that you do not sell through an auction, for reasons that the Gemara is about to articulate. And so what... what our Mishnah is describing now, when the Mishnah is talking about, you know, slight miscalculations on the part of Beis Din, must be talking about these things. Masha Einkein Amemar, when he says that an auction must be done, is talking about property. Okay, let's go through all three. Why these three things not sold through auction? Avadim, time amai shama yishmu v'yivrachu. So the Gemara says, as far as slaves are concerned, so you're going to sell a slave through an auction. So what does that mean? So it's going to be advertised that this slave is for sale. This slave is for sale. Okay, I see I got tripped up. So the, okay, I but that was a tongue twister. Okay, and he's for sale, and he likes it where he is right now. Meaning, now I'm going to be sold to another family? No, thank you. So he hears about it, he's going to run. So it's a flight threat. The mitaltalin ushtarish amiyignavu. Now, when it comes to movables and it comes to documents, so you put them up for auction. So what does that mean? It means that the owner wants to part with them. Well, once we're advertising that, so then, unfortunately, unscrupulous people are going to help themselves. Oh, you want to part with it? No problem. I'd love to help you part with it. So people are going to come and steal from them.
Everything must go in store.
Right, correct. Everything must go. Okay. Okay, that's one way to resolve the discrepancy. So again, so a Maamar says that Basin absolutely needs to do an auction, so that will go on property. And our Mishnah is talking about things that are not sold by auction, like we just got done describing. Ebay, same, the Gemara gives a second approach. Kan b'shashem achrizin, kan b'shashem achrizin. So the Gemara says that there's a time and place, and now we're talking about there's a right time. There's a right time to auction, and there's a right time not to auction. Da'ami Nahardai, the Gemara taught us that through the Yeshiva Nahardai. We saw this earlier in the Masechta. Karga mazon el kvura mezavdina b'loch razasa. Sometimes you need money right away. The need for money right away is going to give us an exemption from having to do an auction. The three examples where you need money right away: karga, head tax. So you have the local government coming after you because of a tax that you owe, and so that's something, that's money you need right away. Number two, mizone, right? We need somebody needs to eat. The children need to eat. The widow needs to eat. Someone needs to eat. So again, that's money we need right away. And finally, kvur, someone needs to be buried. So if properties are going to be sold for any one of these three things, which are pressing needs, so therefore we don't do an auction. An auction, it'll take a month to sell the property through an auction. Here we need the money much quicker than that. So under these circumstances, we sell without an auction. And so therefore, good. So our Mishnah could be talking about times when you sell property and you simply do not use an auction. Ebay Seima. Gemara is now going to give a third possible approach, and that is kama makom shemachrizin, kama makom she'en machrizin. And now in approach number two we talked about time, and now in approach number three we talk about place. Certain places you sell through auction, some places you do not sell through auction. I'm Rav Nachman me'olam lasu igaris b'koris b'narada. Rav Nachman, who happens to be the head, the Marda Asra of the town of Narada, so he describes that in Narada we never sold the property through an auction. And you know why? So suffering minam mishum debiki. Now the Gemara thought that, I'm sorry, mishum debiki b'shuma. So the Gemara thought, well, you know why? Again, the whole reason of an auction is to make sure that we're generating the fair market value of the property. That's what we think. And, well, no, I'm sorry, that's correct. And the reason why Narada they don't do it is because, you know what, in Narada everyone is expert appraisers. And we don't need an auction in order to establish what the fair market value is of any given property. But the Gemara says, but that's not it. No, that's not the explanation. No, I heard it directly from Rav Nachman, and the explanation is a much different explanation. And mishum dekarluhu b'nei achlin nechse dach razasa. Because when you go to a public auction, and you buy in a public auction, it gives you a certain reputation. And let's compound that with, what are you buying at this auction? You're buying property of an orphan. So, understood, everything is within right and legal and perfectly acceptable, but when all said and done, so basically, you're eating the property of orphans. Now again, it could be framed differently, it could be explained differently, but when all said and done, that's what you're exploiting the orphans. Right, again, I understand where it can give a different angle to the incident, a much different angle, but still. And so therefore Rav Nachman says that as a rule, we don't auction in Narada. We don't want people having this kind of reputation.
So against foreclosure, buying
foreclosure. It's it's more than that though. It's buying foreclosed properties from orphans. You know, from kids who, for whatever reason, they Basin has come in and said that they need to generate income and money, and it's, you know, correct. Okay, I'm Rav Yehuda Mishmol. Mitalton shall yisom misham osom mochin osom la'alter. Okay, the Gemara quotes the name of Shmuel, that movables of orphans, so there you appraise them and you sell them right away. Rav Chista, I'm Avime, mochin osom la'shvakim. Now, according to Rav Chista, according to Avime, you sell it at market. So in other words, these two statements are not perfectly compatible. Because the first statement is, in other words, sell it right away. In other words, don't wait. In other words, get the money for the metaltalin. Well, again, we're talking now about movables. The second statement is, no, let's wait. wait for the market, and at the market, people are buying and selling, and there's, you know, a lot of business and a lot of activity, and so high volume, if you will, in a market. So velo pligi. The Gemara says, now the truth of the matter is, these statements seemingly are incompatible, but they're not incompatible. Had de mekar shuka, had de merchak shuka. Depends how far away we are from market time. In other words, if we're somewhere close within market, Rashi describes it as being Yom HaDeshuka, okay, very close to market. Meaning, if today's market, that's I don't think that's what Rashi means, but anyway, it means basically that we're somewhere within proximity of market day, so then it's better to wait. Because even though that means that we're going to have to wait, but at the same time, however, at market day, we're going to get a good price for these movables. Rav Kahana, I'm sorry, but if we're far away from market day, so then you should sell it as quickly as you can. Waiting is only going to delay, and it may not. You have to factor in the amount of time that we have to wait versus the money I can get right now. Okay, Rav Kahana v'abiyade shichra derav mishar shebarchika yasma. Rav Kahana was holding on to, he was entrusted with the beer of Rav Mishashi Bar Chikai Yasma. In other words, so he was entrusted with the beer of the orphans. And so now, the beer is obvious.
He's an adult, no?
Huh?
The orphan sounds like he's an adult, Rav.
It sounds that way, but it's certainly not.
Or maybe like a retroactive story.
Or maybe it's talking about his orphans. Okay, I'm not perfectly clear. Now, obviously, beer is it's going to expire, huh?
Perishable.
Thank you. It's okay. It's my brain froze. It locked. Okay. So beer is a perishable. So now that beer is a perishable, so once again, you want to generate revenue for the kids, so you want to sell it. But he took a risk. Shaya ad rigla. And so what he did is he waited till Yontif. And again, good. So now, again, everything's a risk, and so he held on to it. Now here, it's a perishable, and it could sour. And meanwhile, he took the risk and he waited till Yontif. Amar afagav denafaba itzitzasa maisi zuze charifa. So he said, "Look, I know, I understand the risk. It's going to sour a little bit, and that's true, but." Again, once we get to Yontif, people are going to want to buy beer in, and so therefore I'll be able to generate more income by waiting. Okay, so the Gemara over here is not giving us, like, you know, delineated halacha, but basically, you know, obviously with every business transaction is going to be risk, but basically you're looking for the best profit that you can make on behalf of the orphans. Ravina hava biyad chamad de Ravina. Ravina, I'm sorry, chamad de Ravina zute. Yasma bar Achte, Ravina was also entrusted with the wine of the of Yisomim, and on top of that, it was his nephew. Havali didei nami chamra, and he too also had wine. Havakamasik leilas sechra. Now he was going to a town. The name of the town was called Sechra, and. Also, the comment to Rav Ashi. And he goes over to Rav Ashi and he says as follows. Look, I'm bringing my own wine to sell in Sichra. Now, again, we're traveling. It's always going to be a risk. And I want to know, can I treat the orphan's wine the same way I treat mine? Meaning, I'm ready to go to town. I'm ready to sell. And I understand there's always going to be risk involved. Do I have to be more cautious with the wine of the Yisomim than I do with my very own wine? And so the answer that was given to him by Rav Ashi is, it's no better than yours. Meaning, don't treat it any more special than yours. If you're ready to accept this kind of risk for your wine, so then for sure you could treat it the same with the orphan's wine as well. And so, okay, let's see. As a general rule, I don't know how far to extend this, but basically, you know, it's treat it the same way you treat your own. Okay, Ad Kan, that takes us to the end of the discussion. We start now the next and final Mishnah of the 11th parak.
Can you go back to Evan Gamliel? He said 50%, right?
Well, he doesn't say that, but
so when he said, you know, 100 for 200, Not 200 for 150, but we said 100.
Yes,
200,
yes, I know.
It's double.
Right.
It's 150.
Right. I made a comment to this extent yesterday. That it's not. No, it's fine. It's fine. It's all I did was just make a comment. It was not a big deal. So you don't have to listen to every word I say. But the I know you do. The but anyway, the no, you're right. It's that's not 50%. That's right. That's 100. Right. That's 100. That's 100%. Understood. Half over there as a fraction just simply means in either direction. You're right. It's not right. It's not formulaic. Okay. Final mission of the 11th perek. Let's begin. We've talked in the past about forfeiture of ksuva. It's something we've covered in the past, and there basically are two reasons that there would be a forfeiture of ksuva. Number one, her behavior, which is something we already discussed in the past. In other words, if a woman behaves in such a way where she's a moreda, she rebels, or she's overa saldash, she goes against the Torah. Remember, we discussed going against the Torah that adversely affects him, the husband. So behavior in of itself is going to be a forfeiture of ksuva. And sometimes just the nature of the marriage is such that even just the nature of the marriage is going to be a forfeiture of the ksuva, and that's what we're going to be discussing right now. Okay, so three women we're going to be discussing. Now, it's three women, but it's really for three totally different reasons there's going to be a forfeiture of ksuva. Number one, Mama Enes. Let's take this step by step, one by one. This is all, we've seen all this before, but we get to now put these three women together. Outside of the fact that there is a forfeiture of ksuva, these women don't have very much to do with one another. Meaning, if I put these three women up there and I said, what's the common denominator of these three women, you'd be hard-pressed to find exactly the common denominator. Number one, Mema Enes. A girl's father, unfortunately, passes away, and she's still a katana. And now if the father would have been alive, the father could have married her off, but now the father's no longer alive, so what happens? The Chachamim instituted that. Either her mother or her brother is given the right to marry her off. Now, this is not a Torah-given right. This is only a rabbinic right for the mother or the brother to marry her off. And she will now marry a man, but this is not a marriage of the Torah because she doesn't have das. And there's no father to provide her the das. So, therefore, she will be... this marriage only works on a derabbanan level. And, as we've discussed extensively in Masechta Yevamos, she can walk away from the marriage at 12 years of age when she turns 12. So now she can make a decision and say, I am mima'en. I refuse, and I'm done. I'm done with this marriage. And the example in the Torah, it's not in the Torah, it's, you know, it's rabbinic, but an example in which a marriage can be annulled. By her walking away from the marriage, she basically is annulling the marriage all the way from its point of origination. They were simply not married. Under those circumstances, she's not going to get a ksuva. Now, for a very simple reason. Right, correct. There was no marriage. Right, we expunged the marriage by her walking away, so therefore there's no ksuva. Number two, shnia. I know that's coincidental. That number two is shnia. But shnia, as you know, we also discussed this back to Masechta Yevamos in the second parak, where the Torah gives us a list of women that we're not allowed to marry. They're what's called arayos. Just a couple weeks ago, we did it in the Parsha, right? The Parshas of Achrimos and Kedoshim tell us women in the Torah they cannot marry. And the Chachamim also siag the Torah. They made a fence around the Torah. And they added a whole bunch of other relatives that a man cannot marry. See the Gemara in Yevamos, Daf Chaf Aleph, for an extensive discussion of all the women that the Chachamim added on. So if a man marries, let's say for example, just one simple example, his grandmother, so that is a shnia, she's a secondary erva, and so that's a prohibited marriage, but it's prohibited not min haTorah, it's prohibited mid derabbanan. That also will result in a forfeiture of a ksuva for reasons I'm about to articulate. And finally, the third example, the third woman over here that we're describing is an islandess. An islandess is a woman who does not have the equipment to have a child. She is anatomically unable to have a child. And the term that's used to describe her is called an eyeless, from the word isle, which is a ram. So in other words, she has, I guess in a modern sense, we can call her hormonally imbalanced, but whatever the case is, she cannot. She simply cannot have children. And if she didn't disclose that information to her husband before she married him, so that's what's called the mekach taos. And so therefore, the marriage is going to be the marriage is going to be dissolved, but not because it needs to be dissolved. It just simply is dissolved based on the fact that that's basic information she didn't disclose to him, and so therefore it is a mekach taos.
She needs a get
or no? Nope. The marriage is just simply it never happened because it was that's information she needed to disclose. With all that stated, so now let's see the Mishnah inside. So hamima enes veha. So these three women, ein lahem ksuva. So they all do not receive a ksuva. Okay, now, why not? So now that we have identified who these three women are, so let's go through the reasons for each one of these three women. So take a look at Rashi. Rashi goes and holds our hand and takes us through each one of these three. Rashi says, "Ein lam ksuva me'me'enos mishum de'me'atma yotza." So first of all, in terms of Mion, so Rashi says she's walking away from the marriage. Okay, in other words, a ksuva is when the husband divorces his wife and lets her go. But here she walks on her own. So she doesn't get a ksuva. Next, shnia, knasa derabbanan hu. As far as the shnia is concerned, so this is a rabbinic penalty where she's going to forfeit a ksuva. The obvious question to ask, which we asked in the past, but we're going to re-ask and re-answer, and that is, why punish her?
Right.
Meaning, he also got into a marriage called the shnia. So Rashi continues to write, kedamrina biyavamas beperek yesh mutaros, mimne shehi margilaso lenosa. So Rashi says that we're going to generalize in this scenario and assume that she was the one who instigated this marriage. Why? Why do we assume that? So Rashi goes on to write, she'ena mafsedes klum b'nisuin, because in such a marriage she has nothing to lose in this marriage. She'ena nifsels behen, she doesn't become disqualified through this marriage. Uvla de kasher, and any child that they produce is not going to be a mamzer. So the child is going to be fine. So she'll be unaffected. Her children will be unaffected. So therefore, she was the one. We're assuming it is an assumption, but she was the one who instigated the marriage, and therefore the penalty goes towards her, and that she will now be forfeiting her ksuva. And finally, islands mishum de mekach taosu, and the islands does not get a ksuva because it's a mekach taos, because. It is.
The husband knows about it.
Oh, well, hold on. That's coming up. And if her husband knew about it beforehand, then the marriage is a marriage. It's not a mekach taos. Okay, the Mishnah is going to make that point. Okay, that is number. That's consequence number one. Is that all three of these women will not be getting a ksuva. Consequence number two in the Mishnah. V'lo peiros. Also, there will not be peiros. Let's go right to Rashi. Rashi says, what does that mean, peiros? She doesn't get peiros? What are we talking about? We're well into the Masechta. We already know enough to know. What do you mean? She never gets peiros. What are we talking about? It's the husband who's getting peiros. So Rashi immediately jumps in. Rashi says, din peiros. What it means is that of course, she doesn't get peiros. She never does. He gets the peiros. It means the exchange for peiros. V'hu pirkona, and that is that we know that when a woman is taken captive, the husband has a responsibility to ransom her. That responsibility to ransom her is predicated on the fact that the husband gets the peiros. It's the quid pro quo of he gets the peiros, therefore he gets to ransom her. It's I told you the mnemonic to remember this is the pay. Peiros for pirkona for ransoming. So if she's taken captive, he does not have to ransom her. Why? Rashi continues to write, did tonight ksuva kiksuva, because this is part of the condition stipulation of every ksuva. Hardwired into every marriage are the tanai ksuva, the conditions of a marriage, the basic conditions of a marriage. And tanai ksuva kiksuva, once she forfeits her ksuva, she's also forfeiting her tanai ksuva as well, and so therefore he does not have to ransom her. Became a day in la ksuva, ain la tanai ksuva. Okay, Rashi, I'm not going to continue in Rashi, but if you would like to see an alternate explanation of what the Gemara means, so continue in Rashi, but for our purposes, this is what we're going to cover together. Next consequence, lo mizonos. These women are not going to get mizonos. Now, let's go right back to Rashi. Now, here, there's no Dibra Maschel. We're going to go to the end of the brackets in that Rashi that we just finished reading, and we're going to go. Rashi is going to explain why doesn't she get mezonos? Nami tanai ksuva ninu, because mezonos is also part of the stipulation of a ksuva. We'll come and prepare basa amrina ketsa amra ma'menesin la mezonos. Now Rashi foreshadows for us a very basic issue. I understand that the shnia is not going to get mezonos, and I certainly understand the alnis is not going to get mezonos because again, the marriage was an unsanctioned marriage. However, the mema'enis, what are we talking about? When she's married, she's certainly going to get mezonos. When she does mion, they're no longer married. When exactly are we saying she's not getting mezonos? That's the Gemara later on. Rashi quotes it. So Kate said, "I'm a ma'menes in la mezonos yet. I yachol ma bioshev tachtav shari ba'ala chay b'mezonos el." While they're married, of course the husband has to support her. So alala she'im halach l'medina seyam. So Rashi over here, again, this is Rashi quoting the Gemara later on. So Rashi says, I'll tell you what, when the ma'menes is not going to get mezonos. Let's say the husband goes away on a trip. And so now you have this married woman. Again, she's a woman. She's a girl. But she have a married girl. And Velavsa, so she's going to borrow. And she's going to tell the creditor, look, my husband is obligated to feed me, so he'll come back and he'll pay you back. Va'achla va'amda umiana. And then what does she do at 12 years of age? She walks away from the marriage, so ain't a mishalim. So now the husband says, look, you know, had you remained as my wife, so then obviously I would have been obligated to pay you for those, for the food that you ate, but now that you did mion, so I'm not going to pay back the creditors.
The thing is that at the time that she incurred that expense, she was his wife.
Right.
He had an obligation to feed her.
Right. So the word wife...
It's like retroactive.
I understood. Your point is very good. It's an excellent point. But the term wife over here is a very tenuous term. The fact that she has the ability to walk away means that it's the marriage is so tenuous that when she walks away, it retroactively redefines what was.
That's why she needs a guest.
Well, she doesn't know. She doesn't need to get.
No, doesn't need
to get. Not under the circumstance where she was married by either the mother or the brother. No gets necessary. Okay, so good. So that's the and I'm sorry. One more thing to go through in the Mishnah. I know this part of the Mishnah is going very slow, but there's just every point over here needs to be explained. Velo belos, and the last thing we're going to be discussing is the belos. She's going to come into the marriage with clothing. Okay, now she can structure that clothing into the marriage as one of two ways, like we've discussed again, time and again, and that is either the clothing can come in as nechse malug, meaning that clothing will be fundamentally hers, but he will be able to enjoy the peros of that clothing. What is considered peros of clothing? Stay tuned, that's a discussion we will have later this morning. If this sounds familiar, it should, because we discussed this in the past, in terms of how do you view clothing in terms of its principle and its peros and its fruit. Or if she wants, she can come into the marriage and she could put the clothing into the ksuva. What I mean by that is appraise the value of the clothing, write that into the ksuva, then the clothing go to him. He'll make whatever use of the clothing he wants, but at the conclusion of the marriage, he's going to have to, right, if she doesn't predecease him, so then all that value, which is written to the ksuva, is going to go to her. Okay. Adkan, that takes... No, that does not take us to the end of the Mishnah. I'm sorry. That just takes us to the... the next stage of the Mishnah. Okay, good. Im etzchila nasa l'shem alas yesh laksuva. Okay, Phil, this was your point. If she says to him, look, before we get married, just some basic information you should know about me, I'm an islandist. And he says, okay.
Buyer beware.
Yeah, in other words, and he says, fine. I'm okay with that. So obviously the marriage now is in fact a marriage. However, if the marriage was a Torah prohibited marriage, so then she has her ksuva. Why would that be? Rashi goes on to explain. Because under these circumstances, she already is being penalized in this marriage. Say, for example, any one of these. But say, for example, the case where it's a mamzer, right? What does that mean about their children? Their children are going to be a mamzerim. So in other words, there's already a built-in penalty to this marriage. Or let's say it's a going to a grusha. So what happens when she enters into this marriage? She's going to become a halala. Her children are going to become halalim. So there's already a built-in penalty. So, knowing that, who instigated this marriage? So if you take a look at Rashi, Rashi says, again, we're going to generalize, but generally speaking, we're going to assume it was he who instigated this marriage. And so therefore, under these circumstances, the kenas goes in his direction, and therefore he has to pay her a ksuva. Now I can say it. Now we got to the end of the Mishnah.
But the issue is that the whole point of the ksuva was to discourage him from getting married.
Right.
So now she's getting ksuva, she's not really being discouraged.
Your point is excellent, and that's why Rashi explains that this is a kenas. Meaning you're right. Meaning
it's a kenas on the husband.
Correct.
She's not being really discouraged because you're getting a two.
I understand, but the kenas could have come another way. In other words, they could have, you know, formulated maybe a different, like, in other words, just simple, okay, we're going to penalize you for doing that. They wrap the kenas into a ksuva, which I understand. Your point is very good, meaning it kind of defeats the purpose. In other words, we're trying to encourage them to divorce, and the ksuva does the opposite. So it's a well-taken point. But still, the idea is that he's going to get penalized. Okay, Rav Tani Ketani Yotze Begeni Ela Ksuva V'Kol Shekein Ma'menes. Now, we learned the Mishnah, there were three women being described in our Mishnah. Me'ma'enes Shnei Anayelis. However, Rav, when he had our Mishnah, he had a different gears of the Mishnah. He didn't have the word Ma'menes, but he had rather Ketani Yotze Begeni. Which means, again, same starting point. A girl gets married not by her father, but by her mother or by her brother. And it's the husband now who divorces his wife. Okay. Now again, this is unusual. The whole thing's unusual. In other words, the marriage is not minatara. It's a rabbinically instituted marriage. The Chachamim basically gave shape to this marriage, but the Chachamim gave shape to the marriage. So, for all intents and purposes, they're going to treat it like a regular marriage. And that means then that the husband, if he wants to, he could divorce her. In other words, she could walk away from the marriage at the time when she turns 12. But if the husband wants to, he can give her a get, even at an earlier point in time. And what Rav is teaching us is that if the husband gives her a get, there's not going to be a ksuva. That is a right, very good. That is a big chiddush, as the Gemara will about to articulate, and we'll explain the reason why in just a moment. And now, if that in such a case she's not going to get a ksuva, certainly Mion at that point in time is like you already told us like the big chiddush. So by Mion, of course, she's not going to get a ksuva because then the marriage was never a marriage. Shmuel tani ma'menes ein la ksuva. Now Shmuel says no. Shmuel has actually our girsa of the Mishnah, which is that the woman being described as the ma'menes, she doesn't get a ksuva ein la ksuva val yotza b'get yesh la ksuva. But if she is released from the husband through a get, so then therefore she's going to get a ksuva. Now, Phil made an excellent point, which is, of course she gets a ksuva. She was married.
Right.
That makes a lot of sense. And therefore, it only really begs the question, what's behind the opinion of Rav? Stay tuned, as we're going to hear today, a really big chiddush. V'az d'shmul atame, d'amr shmul. Now, as far as Shmuel is concerned, Shmuel is consistent because Shmuel holds Mema'ena Sein Laksuva that if a woman does mian, she doesn't get a ksuva. Because again, it's an annulment of the marriage. Yotze beget yesh laksuva. If the husband divorces her, she gets a ksuva. Mema'ena Sein Laksuva Menachin. If a girl does mian, so again, there was no marriage. And because there was no marriage, if he wants to marry her ex-husband's brother, she could do that. Velo pasam in a kahuna. Let's say she wants to marry a kohen. Once again, she's not a divorcee. She can marry a kohen. Yotze beget pasam anachin and pasam anakuna. However, if the husband divorces her, so again, if we're going to treat this like a marriage, and therefore she can't marry the husband's brother. It's an erva. She can't marry a kohen. She's a grusha. Fine. A woman who does mian, she doesn't have to wait 3 months before marrying another man. But if, however, she got a divorce from the husband, she needs to wait 3 months in order for her to marry another man. So, this is all statements by Shmuel. You know what Shmuel's saying? It's very simple. What Shmuel's saying is that when a girl is being married off by either her mother or by her brother, even though this is a rabbinically instituted marriage, for all intent and purpose, practically speaking, we're going to call this a marriage. Now, if she does mian, so she's annulling the marriage. But otherwise, if he divorces her, so they were married. With all the ramifications of marriage. Let's go back to Rav. Rav is really difficult. Rav is saying that if he divorces her, he doesn't give her a ksuva. He doesn't give her a ksuva, so then what was that? Rashi writes, I know I'm going backwards. Take a look at the Rashi in the previous Amud. Rav Tani Ketana Yosef Begeni Laksuva, short Rashi. Kasavar einisui katana ela kemefuta ba'alma. Rav's understanding of nisui katana, a minor getting married, again, for purposes of clarification, we're not talking about where the father marries her off, because when the father marries her off, that's a bona fide marriage of the Torah. We're talking about where the brother or the mother marries her off. So according to Rav, that's not marriage. I don't know what to call it. I'll be at a loss of words in order to give it a good description. I mean, Rashi says it's mefuta ba'alma. Okay, they're living together. I'm not even giving a literal translation of Rashi, but it's not a marriage, and it has no ramifications of marriage, including her ksuva, including everything we described. Okay, it's a very interesting shita, but as we'll see in just a moment, Rav's position, he didn't just generate this on his own. This already goes back to the Tanayim. I'm sure he does. In other words, she'll do Mion.
I can't believe it if he doesn't believe it's a marriage. Even
for Shmuel, let's think this through. Even for Shmuel, who says for all intents and purposes this is a marriage, Shmuel believes in Mion, meaning according to Shmuel, she could do Mion.
Right.
So,
right.
You're going to get burned on one side of this discussion. Meaning, I agree with you. I'm with you. But either way, you're going to get to a point where there's an illogical step. According to Shmuel, it's a marriage, but she can walk away. Okay. According to Rav, it's not a marriage, but she still needs to do me in. Right. One way or another, there's a built-in inconsistency. But okay, these are the two opinions. Now the Gemara first.
When you do miyun, it's midrabbanan, right? The marriage.
The marriage to begin with was midrabbanan.
Is that what stage?
No. It's before she becomes. No. It's right at the point where she turns to an adult. In other words,
but what stage was she before Harrison and Nisuin?
No, they were married. What do you mean, Harrison and Nisuin? They're married. In other words, they're husband and wife.
You have to wait 3 months. You may be pregnant.
So Rashi says, that's a good question. But Rashi addresses that. Rashi says that she's too young. She's a katana. She's not going to get pregnant. Okay. So, my kamashma and tanina kulu. So the Gemara says now, you know, Shmuel's position, we did the Gemara Yevamos, we did the Mishnah and Yevamos. You know what Shmuel just taught us? He taught us a Mishnah. Now, hopefully you remember, and even if you don't, it's a Mishnah in Yevamos. And the Gemara just quotes the Mishnah, Amem ha'enes b'ish, hu mutar b'krovaseh, hi mutar b'krovav, v'lo pasal min ha'kohuna, nasan laget, hu asa b'krovaseh, v'hi asur b'krovav, v'lo pasal min ha'kohuna. Okay, I know I just ran through that Mishnah, but that Mishnah, point by point, told us exactly what Shmuel told us. So, Tzrich L'Hamtin Gimel Chadash, and it's Tzrich Leh. There was one point that Shmuel added that wasn't taught to us by the Mishnah Yevamos, and that is her, if she gets to get, she has to wait 3 months before she remarries. Now again, she's not going to get pregnant, but as Rashi points out, any woman who receives again has to wait 3 months. Lo plug rabbanon. The rabbis made no; they did not discriminate in this halacha. Lema kitanai, and let's now suggest the following: we just saw a machlokes between Rav and Shmuel in terms of how to view the marriage of a katana. Again, not married by her father, but married by either her mother or by her brother. Rav basically says it's not marriage. Shmuel says no, it is. And this machlokes between Rav and Shmuel is really, isn't it just a machlokes between Rav Elazar and Rav Yehoshua? Let's see this inside. Rav Elazar omer ein ma'ase ketana klum vein bala zaka b'metziasa, the husband doesn't get her findings, v'lo b'ma'ase yada, doesn't get her earnings, v'lo b'afaris nedareha, and doesn't get to annul her vows. Ena Yerusha, doesn't inherit her. Ena Mitami La, is not Mitami for her. Kol Shadaver, Eno Ki Ishto Lechol Daver. Let's say generally, they're not married. Ela Shetzricha Mion, but she has to do Mion, right? That's like what I said to you. Meaning they're not married, but she has to do Mion, right? You're going to get stuck at one point over here. Rabbi Yoshua Omer Maisa Katana Klom, and Rabbi Yoshua says no. The Maisa Ketana Kluma Bala Zaka Memetziasa. Look, it is something. Husband is going to receive her findings. Amasi Adah is going to get her earnings. Farfars Nadareha. He'll be able to annul her vows. Yerusha, he will inherit her if she predeceases him. Umitameila, and he'll become tami for her if he's a Kohen. Kol Shadaver Harei Kish Lecholdaver Elishiyotze Bemiyan. They are married, but she can walk away by doing Miyan. Okay. So now, Lema Rav Damakar of Elazar Shmuel Damakar of Yoshua. And so now, what do we have really? Really, this machlokus between Rav and Shmuel is really the machlokus between Rav Yoshua and Rav Elazar. Isn't it? It's the same, basically. It's parallel machloksim. Now, you know, and we'll do this quickly, but you know, the Amoraim don't want that. They don't want to be pigeonholed into one opinion of one Tana. So, I'll leave it to Rav Elazar kulei amalo pligi. So, the Gemara says like this. Look, according to Rav Elazar, who says that the marriage of a Ketana is zero, it's nothing. So for sure, what you're going to have to do with Rav Elazar is you're going to have to line him up with Rav, and Shmuel's going against Rav Elazar. The Gemara says that you just can't get out of that. However, ki pliga libid Rav Yoshua. But you know what, though? I can fit both opinions within Shitas Rav Yoshua. How? Shmuel ka Rav Yoshua. So Shmuel's easy. Because Shmuel says that the marriage of a ketana is a marriage for all intent and purposes, even though it was rabbinically formulated, but they treat it like a full-fledged marriage. However, Rav can also fit into Rav Yoshua. How is that going to work? I can look at Rav Yoshua because Rav Yoshua says like this: we're going to treat it like a marriage, but in one direction, meaning from her to him. But we're not going to treat it as a marriage in the direction from him to her, in that she won't get a ksuva. So that's how Rav can fit into the opinion of Rav Yeshua. It only begs the question, why would that be? We'll finish today. It's a good question. So to finish up with Rashi. Rashi writes, Ad kan lo kamar Rav Yeshua. Demase kayamim ela midida li didei. Kigon Yerushasam asiyadem asiyasa shi'u labal. Ki heichid lo limnu milisa osa. Remember, why did the Chachamim do all this? Meaning, let's come back to like a core issue over here in this discussion. The Chachamim did this to protect the girl. The girl's running around right now without a father, and it's an unfortunate situation. And so, therefore, the Chachamim want to incentivize men and say, "Men, look, right? She's a girl. It's not a marriage. Not midaraisa. But you know what, though? Take her home, marry her, protect her." And so therefore they incentivize the husbands to do so. So therefore, anything going from her to him, so that's going to be enforced, because again, that's there to incentivize the men to take them in order to protect them. But in other words, there's no need to give her the ksuva, meaning because that's not going to incentivize the men to take her on. If then, as she becomes an adult, and then this marriage converts from a marriage de Rabban to marriage de Raisa, obviously then, all the mutual exchanges of a marriage are going to be instituted under those circumstances. So, it could be that Rav Shita fits in even to Rabbi Yoshua. We'll stop over here. In this regard, Rav Elazar, generally speaking, is a shita that is generally not the accepted one. In this regard, we go like Rav Yoshua.